I figure this is a different saint lore, right? Because we don't, we're not, this is, we know who Jesus is. Fiction or fact, there's a lot of lore already publicly accessible
Yeah,
around.
he seems, some people seem really into him.
Yeah, definitely Whoopi Goldberg.
I mean, aren't we all collectively in danger, girl?
Yes, and doo-wop does sound better in Latin.
When we're back in the habit, yeah.
Yeah. I never know. I just know that there's supposed to be an intro. Anyway, hello everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of Radio Free Golgotha. And by very special, I mean in the British way of just singular. And a special, is that? Yeah. Yes. But episode 33, 30 the third. And it is not only our Jesus episode, it is our Jesus episode, Jesus year episode. Well, this, I'm already messing this intro up hugely. Al, you should talk.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here, and thank you especially, Jesse, for being here. My
And inarticulate, yes.
you make me look so good.
My thanks.
It's our Come to Jesus episode 30 to 3rd, exactly. So if you've made it this far, then you're doing as well as Jesus of Nazareth, potentially. I don't know. Perhaps that's a statement that I will come to regret. Hi, everyone. Hello. Welcome. And
How many
on this
starts can we have to this episode? Great.
I'm just going to keep saying welcome.
Yes, welcome.
Just to make our friend Cooper's editing job all the easier. Thanks, Cooper. Really appreciate you. So,
In true Golgothite fashion, the focus of our 33rd episode, which conveniently timed to being because we have missed so many months in our 7 years plus now, timed out to be around our March episode being Good Friday and being a Golgothite cult, because, why not make more accusations about us out there? We are glorifying the Golgothite cause and celebrating Jesus as our saint today, and Judas Iscariot as our demon, which of course has lots of baggage and otherwise around, but it's still a fruitful exploration, I would propose. And on this 33rd episode, we are focusing on myrrh. I cannot believe we have not tackled myrrh before now.
I
So
know, right?
this seems similarly, we are
Similarly.
tackling emerald as our stone, which I also cannot believe that, like, one of the few actual precious stones has not been spoken about yet. So, myrrh and emerald and the magic of sacrifice, which is a very on the nose or very on the cross, as it were. And our arcana of the day, our trump is the sun. Our figure is Letizia. And, the overlapping correspondences with the Ordu Obara Meji, nominally, fictitiously, and perhaps secretively. And our dead magician, you may think we're not doing our work, but there is a lot on Jesus as a magician out there. So Al in particular has expressed a great interest in not wading through it all, because it is rather unsurmountable when we get into it. But Jesus and the Golgothite cause, as our dead magicians take a shot.
Exactly. Buckle up, folks. Very excited to slouch our way to Calvary
Insert
and kick off.
cue music here. I don't know. Maybe we already played the music. Have fun, Cooper. All right. So I guess starting off is, we're not just talking about the Jesusian ministry here, but specifically, I would think Passiontide is the real interesting focus as far as narrowing it down. So if you're not familiar with Jesus, good job. You've survived the onslaughts of 2,000 years of Westernizing culture and moving through it. But as far as this end of Lent period and the going into Passiontide, Passion Sunday having just passed, we are now launching into the death of Jesus as opposed to the life of Jesus. And yeah, so I guess the thing that kind of launches us into Holy Week and is of interest to me, this being a Good Friday episode, is the starting with Lazarus Saturday, the day before Palm Sunday, which is when Jesus, having waited 4 days to go get one of his best friends up from the dead, resurrects someone to this life again. And the celebration around this, the fear that Jesus wouldn't come and do this. So, Martha calls him out and is basically told, like, be patient. But she's freaking out of, like, if you were here, he wouldn't have died. So Lazarus is rotted at this point, and Jesus indeed resurrects him. And then the famous line of Jesus wept, because this is the beginning of the end. With such public a miracle, the adulation is only going to increase, and therefore he will be of danger to the political machinations of the state.
Right. This seems to be very much the point where he's not just, he's already on the radar of the Judean authorities, right? And the Romans and the, and that itself is one of the first debates, right? How much is one informed by the other? He's definitely already on the radar. He's definitely already, you know, turning some heads and ruffling some feathers. And it's this, it seems it's this act of necromancy that seems to be the thing that really kicks off the beginning of the end, right?
Yeah. In fact, there, you could say that Palm Sunday, in its celebration of Jesus entering Jerusalem, you know, riding an ass and everything, that this is a direct result of the miracle that is Lazarus Saturday, that it propels going forward. So there's this, out of the resurrection of your friend comes your own death, is this interesting kind of riding into the gates of, if we're going to take Christian symbolism at its most, you know, wonderfully appropriate of other cultures, that the gates of Jerusalem become the gates of the heavenly Jerusalem, and that there is already an entering into this understanding of a return to the garden, return to Eden, return to Jerusalem, that is built within the larger Judeo-Christian permutations around spirituality, a return to before the fall. And so Jesus entering in is of interest to me in that way, but in the sense that this is the final, there's no going back after this point. This is where you see, I think on like Tuesday or Wednesday is when he goes again outside to go. And this is the famous bathing with spikenard or myrrh, depending on who is the tradition specifically is. A lot of disagreement about plants and scripture because there's no scientific names given. So,
yeah, archaeobotany is a set of tangled weeds about a set of tangled weeds. So often the name of a plant is a description of it, right? The tall one, the stalky one, the one that grows in shade.
Yeah, bitterness itself. It's mm-hmm.
The bitter one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so that provides ample ground for a bunch of debate. I'm more familiar with the Azov debate about what hyssop is, which is almost certainly not the Mediterranean hyssop a lot of us use today, and the references to it being some form of marjoram. But there's also big debates about what exactly the plant that was used as a spear for the sponge that was given to him with vinegar and with either gall or myrrh again. A variety of arguments about what that plant is based on these descriptions that might have already solidified into taxonomy or might have literally been descriptions.
And also the kind of mapping of the landscape that happens with Christianity as it becomes a world religion is mm-hmm. that you're going to take a local plant that you can then pass that lore onto. And right. So how many woods of the cross are there? How many thorns, different types of thorns are there that are then the lore of Passion Week goes around it? How
right. Many... Without even getting into like which plants sprung up from his blood.
Yes,
and which deity's blood did they spring up for before they yes. were said to spring up from Christ's blood? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of this is, if we're going to talk about like hagiographic blur, Passion Tide is full on hagiographic blur, and it's meant to be within its own narrative, right? This is in fulfillment of the scriptures, in everything is referencing back, which gives the burgeoning Christian cult its authority based in Jewish scriptures, as well as its kind of hearkening to Eastern Mediterranean and especially Greek ideas about divinity in this way, and getting a little bit of little dash of necromancy in there too, and hero cult and restless dead and things like that happen within the church. Of interest to me, I guess, within because of our demon being Judas, which is its own kind of like, is Judas a demon? But the demonization of Judas is certainly there. This is also the week where Judas goes to the Sanhedrin and asks for, you know, what will you give me if I and I will betray him unto you? Like the cause is there. He's not even doing it for like, I'll name my price. He says, you name your price and I'll do it, which has echoes in many ways. It reminds me of the narrative around when Moses goes to Pharaoh and demands for the release of the Hebrew slaves. But Pharaoh, when he asks for a miracle, doesn't ask Moses to surprise him. He asks for Moses to surprise himself with the miracle, which is kind of an interesting thing. There's something in the slight words here of Judas saying, like, what will you give me? And I'll do this. Would not like, if you give me this, I'll do this. So it's, there's lots of narratives here, and there's lots of Gnostic interpretations and various movie plot lines that go through this every few years of Judas being actually incredibly dedicated to the cause, and that this is the thing that allows Jesus to complete his earthly mission is the betrayal. And, you know, scripture wise, we do have Jesus saying, like, better it be for that man that he was never born, which is harsh if Judas is actually in on it all. But Judas is a complex figure and is already, we're bordering into that, you know, strange area with him. But the betrayal happens, and in a matter of hours from like an after party on Thursday night, where Jesus is like drunkenly in a garden that they rented, you know, a nice little Airbnb out, and are contemplating what's going on. and to an arrest, to people going back and forth between the Jewish court and the Roman court in the wee hours of Friday morning, to suddenly by 9 a.m. he's already sentenced and now walking to Golgotha. So, you know, that Christian tradition that, yes, the timeline isn't exactly known. We know the hours when Jesus was on the cross by scripture, the sixth to the ninth hour, which is noon to three. But before that, it's assumed that it was a 3-hour painful, like with the mortification of the flesh of Jesus and the Via Dolorosa itself is like the 3 hours before that. So there's a condensed timeline that's happening here that is directly about divine blood spilling. You know, without going into like the Christian narrative of this as like as its own thing, I personally love what it does for syncretism potentials and the heretical use of it within tradcraft, within Latin American Christianity, is within, you know, non-standard versions and heretical means of interpreting these things. You know, the stealing of any divinity's blood, any divine blood, is quite interesting. The potential for lores of what springs up and as we go through the passion itself, and like Veronica's veil and the image, the transferal of divine power to a physical object in that way, where the face of Jesus is now on a cloth, the significance of the falling three times and God falling to earth the same way angels do, the meeting of your earthly mother, you know, like the reminder of the mortality that this all is, as well as the promise of eternity past it, is all very interesting to me. I guess what comes to mind immediately is the cult of San Simon in Guatemala, where San Simon is syncretized with Peter and Judas, both, and Judas Iscariot originally as well. And then so you have Judas Iscariot, Judas Thaddeus, and Simon Peter all being like this intertangled mess of what San Simon is syncretized with. Mm. And part of that is that there is one writer, I'll remember his name in a bit, it'll come, but I think it's Rites of Sacrifices, his book, where he goes into the history of these kind of complex deities that are combinations of dead kings, amongst other things, but a deity of time itself, akin to kind of a Tezcatlipoca, if you're going to follow the Aztec pantheon. But the five unlucky days that are very common in the world, that are the alignment of the solar lunar calendar every year, that those five unlucky days have deities associated with them, which is the time out of time. And that a figure like San Simon is the trickster that's tied to those days. And that those days, in practice, post-conquest, aren't aligned to a calendar anymore because the solar lunar calendar of native use is banned. But in the Catholic calendar, there are 5 days that are kind of standing out, which is Passiontide itself. So Lent ends on either the Sunday or the Wednesday, depending on how it goes. If Lent is, if you're doing 6 weeks, then it would end on the Wednesday. But Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, in that way of those 5 days are the days out of time. And that San Simon in some parishes is hung from the church tower like Judas hanging himself, or is given new things at this time period. So the whole encapsulation of Passiontide as a time out of time is quite fascinating to me. And exploring the themes of repertoire and archive that are here, that this thing, when it is played out, especially in Latin American Christianity, which was such a repertoire culture, that now it is happening again. That because Jesus is going through this trial of the flesh, that when he is killed on Good Friday, or when he dies on Good Friday, that there is no God on earth in the current time. And that is when things are released, that his blood spilling upon the earth is the birth of demons, that the ripping of the veil of the temple itself allows for the Shekhinah to come out. And it's the true democratization of God on the planet, yeah, through a Christian lens, right? That the breath of Jesus and the Shekhinah are now everywhere on the earth. And this is this, including the devils can take this breath for their power. And the heretical building upon that of, in addition to all of the lovely things that can happen with like seizing a power through Passiontide or finding inspiration for personal power of those things, is after the crucifixion, the use in Caribbean culture of like Good Friday after 3 p.m. up until Easter morning is when the most heavy witchcrafts will be done, because there is no God watching you. There's nothing that prevents us. And you can be forgiven on Easter for all the horrible things you do, uncorking all of your bottles to let the genie out, as it were. But also that Santo Entierro is a concept in many Latin American cultures, Filipino as well, that the body of Jesus itself, the Ecce Homo, this cult that can surround the mortality of Jesus, which is also tied into a concept that I would say maybe 10 years ago, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but you didn't hear the harrowing talked about that much, but it has become much more popular, especially as Cyprianic lore is more around in English. But the concept that Jesus spent 40 hours in hell from his own death until Easter morning, that that's what was going on. He wasn't just in some state of nothingness, that he goes to hell, especially into the outer layers where the good pagans and the patriarchs and Adam and Eve were in limbo. Mm. And he brings them out of the mouth of hell and they are in paradise right away, which, as we talked about before, that most people who die are not in paradise. The saints are, and the good patriarchs and the good people of the Bible are there because they were already dead. But all the rest of us are waiting for the second coming, for Jesus to basically come get us out of limbo in the future. But that notion of the harrowing of hell, the notion of stealing the power of Jesus, you know, brings to mind the kind of Last Supper narrative of like, wouldn't it have been nice if you could have done these things and Father, take me back thing of like, and all of that familiarity and temptation that's there where it is, I don't know, the flash of what it is, the flash of the, it's like that story with Maya where the man meets Arjuna, I think, and says like, I want to understand the power of your Maya. And nothing happens. So the man goes home and he tells his wife, like, yeah, I met a god, but, you know, I asked him to show me the power of Maya. The wife's like, okay. And he lives his life and he has children. And then there's storms in the latter parts of it. It's like a Job figure where all these horrible things happen and his life is going to shit. In his house, he sees his children die of disease and floods are coming and all his possessions are washing away. And he watches his wife drown and he cries out to the heavens, like, I don't understand what's happening. And then flash, he's like last breaths. And he's back on the field talking to, I think, Arjuna. And the god basically says, like, now you understand the power of Maya, which is very Last Temptation of Jesus, right? Of like Jesus saying, Father, take me back. Did it actually happen? Or, you know, or not, of Jesus basically coming off the cross and living the rest of his life as a human. Mm-hmm. And then realizing in old age, like, this was not what has to happen. And I need to go back to the cross. Or was he always on the cross? And this is just the vision of like, what you have to do to tell yourself, like, I need to stay the course type of thing.
Yeah. There's so much, as you pointed out before, like time travel in this sort of the liturgical calendricals of this, but also in terms of, yes, a vision of one's future and of how one comes to terms with something potentially, or doesn't, as the case may be, right? And again, the moment of the period of the crucifixion has so many different either last words or words that were spoken on the cross, depending on, you know, whether we're looking at Luke or John, from some, you know, some very lauded things around, you know, why have you forsaken me, to forgive them, they know not what they are doing, to telling the two thieves that he's with, Gestas and Dismas, who we've talked about before, that they'll be with him, or at least one of them will be with him in paradise, to commending his spirit to the hands of the Father. So John talked in far more kind of like simple or dare I say like human terms about, you know, him saying he was thirsty, or that, yeah, like, woman, here is your son, or just simply like, it is finished, you know. The crucifixion has so much like mythic power, not just in its like in the stations of the cross, but also in like the specifics of what happens as it's going down, as we are in Calvary, the, you know, as the KJV has it, you know, that they were come in unto a place called Golgotha, or Golgotha, that is to say, a place of a skull, right? And then the various debates about whether that means that the actual land itself was skull-shaped from, I believe it's from Origin onwards, it's said to be, this is where Adam's skull was, and that this explains why Jesus is called the last Adam. But with there's a wealth of activities that happen around Jesus building up to being on the cross, from, you know, given this concoction that's sometimes said to be a painkiller, according to Matthew and Mark, he refuses as well, to the Roman soldiers casting lots for his clothes that we see in an awful lot of gambling magic onwards, right? Here is an important mythic moment where dice or lots are being cast. And so that's often folded into dice magic or spellcraft to win at any kind of gaming, to the group of female disciples of Jesus at the crucifixion as well, right? Which all four gospels mention, to Longinus, one of these soldiers, piercing Jesus' side with the lance that then becomes part of the Arma Christi that we've also talked about before, and that blood and water flow out to, as you say, the period of darkness that the synoptics account at his death, and the rending of the veil, the heavy curtain in the temple being torn, to Matthew at least talking about reports of the earthquakes, right, that break open the tombs. And then afterwards to Joseph of Arimathea with Nicodemus's help, removing the body of Christ from the cross and wrapping him up in nice clean cloth and burying him in his tomb hewn from rock, to the discovery of the empty tomb and onwards, right? And then his appearances to Mary Magdalene and the other Mary in Matthew, to other, you know, various appearances and commissions to the disciples to spread the message and for Peter to take care of the sheep and so on. To, again, we're talking about like hagiography and saint lore and the material culture of that, to the vast array of relics associated with this moment and with Jesus' life more generally, I suppose, but specifically, you know, the three nails and the crown of thorns, and as you say, the thing that gets called the Shroud of Turin later. And I was looking and finding it's Erasmus, right, 16th century. theologian who is noted as pointing out, often scholars say somewhat sarcastically about this, like the sheer amount of relics and things, how many pieces of the one true cross does St. Helena find, and how many buildings or how much of a giant would Jesus have been if all of these bones of his were put together and shown to all, if they were all accurate, right? So in that sense, I think that's worth bearing in mind that theologians also looked skeptically at the tourism trade and the sheer economics of relic trade and of translating bones and of making wherever you keep them a destination for pilgrims that you could then, yes, sell eulogia and souvenirs and things, but also this put you on the map, right? And meant you were a place that people visited and knew about, and that therefore there was a certain amount of like political as well as economic power that came with keeping these things. And what more sacred a relic to Christendom than the relics of Jesus himself?
Yeah, just this kind of concept of holy dowsing that happens, holy visionary dowsing, especially with Helena and others, that just like the finders of miracles, it's almost like, I don't mean to belittle this anyway, I'm actually kind of hoping that her intent was true if we're going to accept it at face value. But almost like treasure text finders with the tulkus of Tibetan tradition of like finding things that were meant to be found later on in time. But her going to the Holy Land and discovering the true cross and going to the temple to Aphrodite, to Venus, and choosing that this is the place of the Holy Sepulchre. There's nothing that says that the garden tomb needs to be, you know, so close. But when you're dealing with pilgrims and pilgrimage, that if there is a tomb where they could be plausibly where Jesus was entombed within sight of the hill itself, of Golgotha, then it's much easier to build a basilica that encompasses both those things, and you can get two for the price of one is still a consideration.
Yeah.
You know, individual motivations of whether or not she genuinely believed those things to be true. I absolutely see how someone in a state of religious ecstasy finding a place that they think is Golgotha, the bias will fit, you know, what you think, you know, or the facts will fit your bias. And it doesn't mean that you're misguided. It just means that there's a lot going on, a lot of factors to consider here. Certainly there's the kind of pseudo-chaotic perspective that like, whether or not that's the place, the fact that it has been deemed the place since 325 means that there is a lot of magic associated with this specific place.
Yeah. The patina of the use of a place that like, this is a way of, again, facing the same direction as the pilgrims that came before you. Yeah.
Someone was just saying the terror of something and put the phrase, the terror of the terroir in my head. The awesomeness of it all that we're talking about. This argument came up once for me in the past when I was, you know, very good correspondence friends with Brian Holman, who ran the Curanderismo group long ago. That is the source of a lot of Cyprian and Santissima Muerte lore in English from the early 2000s that has been, that's the most regurgitated thing you see is his original research. But, you know, in my early 20s of wanting Guadalupe specifically to be like, she is Coatlicue, like it's all inappropriate, like it was a thing to say that, oh, this is the goddess in a different form. And of course, my heretical self is like, it's less devious and more just, this is how syncretism works now. But his pointing out that, for instance, the Aztecs were only around for 250 years, their entire empire. And at this point, that hill had been more associated time-wise with the Virgin of Guadalupe than it ever had been with Coatlicue. And it was like a slap in the face of like, oh my God, he's like, if I go off of time alone, the memory of the cult of this place is more of, you know, Guadalupana. So it's not even a like what's right or what's older, because I don't think that's what the point is to understand that, as you said, the patina of something or the terroir of something is a factor into what it can be used for by certain those of us that are seizing the power in that way. If you're going to, you know, march counterclockwise around a church three times or seven times at midnight to steal its power, as one might be wont to do, then steal the power from a good church. You know, I'm reminded of our discussion of Mary of Egypt and her pilgrimage and like wanting to fuck with pilgrims specifically and being unable to enter the Church of the Holy Sepulchre because of the icon over the door. And like this thing of like this basilica that was built by Constantine is so riddled with lore, and it's multiple traditions that are inside of it too, right? Like just as far as the Orthodox and the different Catholic expressions that are all vying for this space and kind of cohabitating, you're like, this is the mixing pot of Christianity right here.
Yeah, there's something for me there as well about how if it's emergent empiricism, or what will later be backtributed as emergent empiricism of science as distinguished from scientia, distinguishing itself from folklore, right? If science is like, no, we are what's proven rather than what is said, that's done to, again, in a variety of ways of consolidating centers of knowledge and ways of knowing and centers of power and truth making and truth distinguishing. But it also leaves folklore as a vast area to explore and engage with, right? Of if it is what is said to be Golgotha, right? Yeah, that's not necessarily making it less potent.
Yeah. And there's alternate sites, right? Like there's the Theneus, the Gordons, Calvary, and all these other places that are like constantly trying to renegotiate. There's so many folk etymologies, backtributions of like, oh, Golgotha actually means this. And it's all very Dan Brown in theme, half of it, right?
I found that definitely with looking up the various etymologies and a ton of backtributions around Judas and the Iscariot itself, right? Yes. That Judas is, I think, some of the most reasonable ones, if we're trying to take a historical basis, are that it's from the name Judah, which is, yes, from the Hebrew meaning praise or praised, but it's an extremely common name for Jewish men during the first century AD. And yes, a lot of the time that's linked back to Judas Maccabeus, like this renowned hero. And that this is also used by an awful lot of anti-Semitic movements to talk about him being the Jewish one of them, right? But then on top of that, you've also got just how many different ways Iscariot is taken, whether it's just means the guy from Kerioth, right?
Yep.
Or if it's, a bunch of the most obvious backtributions are ones where people try and make it mean liar or the false one, or even the one who delivers, or even some Greek Aramaic hybrids, Iscariotha, if I'm not butchering that, meaning chokingness or constriction, which are obviously things to try and explain how it goes down, right? You don't turn up saying, hi, I'm Judas the liar, presumably, right? There's some links to it being a corruption of the Latin word sicarius, like dagger man, which refers to the sicarii, who are a group of like assassins and sometimes called terrorists. But there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of actual evidence that he was anything to do with that lot, and that they come a little bit later or earlier. I'd need to check that. Yeah, that this endeavor to try and make it obvious that Judas is a baddie in various ways, beyond just being one of the 12, and therefore, you know, an important number in terms of reflecting the 12 tribes and so on and so forth. And also, again, to distinguish him from Thaddeus and, as you say, like Peter Simon and stuff, that it becomes the defining characteristic of this Judas, that he is the betrayer who sells Jesus out to the authorities. Some have said for kind of nationalistic reasons, that it's said that he's ready, as you say, he's ready to take whatever he's paid to give Jesus up because he's failed the nationalist project, or he wants the money, or even in Luke and John, it seems suggested that he's potentially possessed, right, by a devil or the Satan. It's also interesting that he betrays Jesus by addressing him as master, right, by kissing him on the cheek in the Garden of Gethsemane, and that this is what like marks him to the authorities, right? He doesn't tell them like he's here. He points at him publicly by showing him apparent veneration. So there's also this kind of like hypocrisy going on, as well as like what is public versus what is private and those kinds of things. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. And then you can start getting into both like some of the apocrypha around like why he's doing this and what he does afterwards, as well as like the philosophical reflections on evil and predeterminism versus free will, right? So you've got Bertrand Russell talking in The Problem of Natural Evil about Judas, as well as Armand Borges in his short story, The Three Versions of Judas. And then problematizing the difference between Judas's actions and eternal punishment. I was reading that scholar Bruce Reichenbach argues this argument that like if Jesus has already foreseen this betrayal by Judas, then it's not an act of free will. And therefore, like, is he punishable if he's like also enacting the grand ineffable plan? But it's also conversely argued that because the betrayal was foretold, that that doesn't necessarily prevent Judas from deciding not to do it. And so he's, yeah, absolutely not just demonized, but like a very expression and example, as well as a player in a parable of what the nature of evil and choosing evil is, as well as, you know, his inevitable, well, maybe not inevitable, right? His inevitable death and mourning. I was reading about in the Gospel of Nicodemus, the whole thing with the chicken coming back to life. So yes, he's supposedly filled with remorse after he finds out that Jesus has been crucified. So that's another element. Like, he doesn't necessarily think that Jesus is going to be crucified. He's just trying to get him out of the way in some way, potentially, in some tellings of this. And so he goes home and tells his missus, who's making chicken dinner, and he's concerned that Jesus is going to come back and, you know, he's going to be pissed, right? Jesus is coming back and he's mad. Everyone look busy, right? And so apparently Judas's wife is trying to mock him about this and trying to, whether, you know, she also hates him for what he's done or is trying to persuade him with humor and says, well, you know, Jesus can't come back any more than this chicken can come back to life. And immediately, supposedly, the chicken is restored to life and begins to crow, which is also that, you know, the cocks crow and the callback to various other kinds of betrayal or saying that you don't know him. And that this is the little miracle that convinces Judas that he needs to run away and hang himself.
Yeah. I mean, even the Because we're doing a lovely hagiographic blur of just blurring the lines between Jesus and Judas's talking, right? Because they're so, the relationship is very strong here, obviously. The notion that Judas, in the Gospel of Judas, right, he's doing it as like the most beloved, trusted disciple of Jesus, that this is what has to happen. So that's, of course, Gnostic second century, but not canonical by any means. So it's the epitome of Apocrypha, but also that Judas in that Gospel has a vision that the disciples like pursuing him and running after him, like pitchfork style of like, we're going to get you. There's two accounts of his death. One is hanging, one is kind of just falling into a field by accident and his guts gushing out, which is, these are kind of combined in a lot of the kind of popular lore that he hangs and no one takes the body down. And so he blows and his guts explode everywhere. And there's a whole thing here of like some tradcraft folklore around like being the patron of trees and the wisdom and the medicine of trees, because he nourishes the tree, that tree, the fig tree, by many accounts, even though it doesn't say fig tree, because the fig tree was cursed by Jesus earlier in the Gospels, the fig tree then becomes perhaps the tree that Judas hangs by. Which, okay, but fig trees aren't that strong either. They're very bad hanging trees.
But it's the tree of shame, right? It's the thing that Adam and Eve cover themselves with when they have knowledge of their nudity.
So there's a lot of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
There, the Akeldama, right? So the field of blood that's been bought, which fulfillment of scripture. And again, Jeremiah coming in here in the prophetic sense, but like going through remorse, trying to take the money back and saying, don't kill him, I don't want it. And then being told we don't want it either. And we can't do anything with it because it's blood money. Mm-hmm. And Mosaic law with blood money being that like, well, let's buy the field. And that's where we can make it a potter's field, which is the origin of our potter's field concept of like, that's where you bury the unknown.
Right.
And the people that can't be buried where everybody else is.
And those whose names have been blotted out as well, which is also something that's sometimes said specifically about Judas, and indeed Jesus in some cases as well. Yeah, the concept of excoriating someone from history as well, not unlike the way that, you know, pharaohs would ensure that their monuments and the tales of their derring do were carved deeply into the stone so that they couldn't be erased from history.
Yeah.
I found from like John Mandeville, so writing in like 1364, where he visits Jerusalem and he claims that he's shown the tree that Judas hanged himself upon. Where is the quote? For despair that he had when he sold and betrayed our Lord. And it's said to be an elder tree. So we've got the fig and the elder. And certainly by the time of our man William Shakespeare, Byron in Love's Labour's Lost comments that Judas was hanged on an elder. And again, in another play, Cymbeline, there's a character in there who laments about the stinking elder. Where's that quote? Let the stinking elder grief untwine his perishing root with the increasing vine. So certainly by like early modern English estimations, like elder, which is already a tree with all sorts of, you know, dark lore associated with it from fairies and madness and poetry, as many of these trees often have, has this link back to him as well. Yeah, I found that really interesting.
And you said that you had looked into the Borges stuff with the three versions, right? There's some interesting things there with the three versions of Judas with Niels Runeberg. Runeberg, yes, the fictitious writer that Borges is talking about, that, you know, Judas himself is, I think the one that's interesting out of that is that Judas is the reflection of Jesus in the human world. It's fascinating. It reminds me of some heretical by Christian standards, but I suppose just kind of Islamic lore, because the Quran says that Jesus wasn't crucified. And we talked about this before, I think even on the show, that there's lore that at the moment of the crucifixion that Judas is kind of projected onto the cross, and it's actually Judas that suffers. Because cannot suffer the same way. And that when Jesus dies on the cross, it is Jesus' spirit, but Jesus kind of comes in the last minute. And Judas is the one that actually suffered and then goes to hanging on the tree, like a double sentence.
Right.
Trail. But I think the three versions of Judas that Borges talks about, one generation removed because of the writer writing the writer, as it were.
Right. It's not a Borges novel unless there's an author writing about another author writing about another author, right?
Yeah.
The Matryoshka doll of literary reflexivity.
Yeah. But there's just this idea that Judas is the one that ultimately leads Jesus down the right path, right? Like to choose the infamous destiny.
This is his main job.
Yeah. To be so human that is the point of infamy, that this would happen, that you would give in to this way. And I think there's a little bit there of the transgression and the rebellion against the divine that is kind of romanticized within many Western European traditional witchcrafts, right? Of, you know, the coin of Judas, of paying for your entry into the circle, which is a very tradcraft thing, that you don't have a right to go in here. You must pay it. You must pay to go into the underworld. It's Charon's fee. It's the fee of the dead, but it's the Judas coin. And so that like, that you throw your coin in as fee and you can take it with you when you leave, or it stays there depending on the nature of the right. But this is all echoing Judas's betrayal. that you are now betraying your human nature to become other. You are now betraying your people to become, to have powers. You're now betraying God to become one with the devil.
Mm.
And there's no way to separate that coin from, you know, within the Christianosphere of relationship to Judas. It's always there. I also am very enraptured by, on the recommendation of Ingrid, of the Our Immortal Soul. The book is fascinating. It's beautiful. It's by Rabbi Nilton Bonder. I was going to say Bender, but it's Bonder. And it's discussing about how our nature as humans, the way for our soul to evolve is through transgression, through sin. And one of the quotes that is given is that the one who deceives themselves is more wicked than the one who deceives others. And this brings to mind even a kind of a Judas and Peter notion here, which you brought up with the cockscrow, of like, in truth, in some of the kind of tribecraft schools, there is this notion of the greater betrayal and the lesser betrayal, and that the lesser betrayal is actually the one of conviction, meaning that Judas turning Jesus in was exactly what was supposed to happen. Like this, you betrayed someone, but it's known. But Peter denying what he thought he was going to do, not only deceived others, he deceived himself. That he didn't get to the test. He didn't pass the test, as it were. And what's interesting about that in this way, that if with Peter as the, you didn't stand up for that which you knew was true in the time period to save your reputation or to save your life in that way. And there's varying accounts of what that's going to be, because of course people are going to have feelings about like, if it saves your life, lie.
Right.
But there's this notion that that is the rock on which the church is built. That Peter, who is the one who committed the greater betrayal, the one who denied Christ, even though he said he wouldn't, just a few hours earlier, is where we start. The church is built upon understanding. I mean, I'm going to put this in the positive spin, not necessarily extolling the church, but the idea that a church can be built upon such betrayal as a way of saying that the humanity of it, or the understanding that no one can necessarily have the courage of their convictions from the beginning, that is not a hero figure.
Right.
That is a flawed figure.
To err is human.
Yeah. Or if you wanted to go off of the kind of a Gurdjieffian model there, I suppose, of like, to be animal is to be human, right? Until it's not. And then we rectify our to err as human through bringing attention to it and becoming more than what we normally would demand of ourselves, that we don't really use our human faculty. We don't really use our Christ nature, that it might be inherent in every part of us. We use our Jesus nature more. And, you know, if you live constantly in defense, that this is animal instinct, that if you live constantly in a state of hunger or thirst or lust, that these are animal instincts, and that humanity can, our human nature can actually be more than that, which allows us to stand by the courage of our convictions, I suppose, as it were.
I think it's Pratchett that has that line about where the falling angel meets the rising ape.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly. Past the Gospel of Thomas with the lion passing through the man and all these other confusing things too. but yeah, so I love the idea of the Judas kiss and what it signifies within popular culture too, of like the mafia legends and things like that.
Mm.
But that there is something fruitful in this betrayal of the angelic, betrayal of established order, and that Judas, as whether it is through the anti-Semitic spin that is given to Judas, as you mentioned, or even, and we know how conflated witchcraft as a political crime, as a modern entity that we understand, is directly and inextricably bound in anti-Semitism and anti-Catharism, like just trying to villainize people to take their property and their riches in Spain and France. But there's something there about the othering that can happen that I think, without dismissing history, but as far as, you know, what I think tradcraft tries to do is to play upon all of that and find power in it. How can you spin this into a narrative that allows you to have power, even in the face of, you know, that it's always heresy, never blasphemy, as it is. Like, how do you use power and not deny it?
Right, and right. Making the story work for you.
Exactly. And so Judas, what does Judas mean for us to betray our master in that way? What are we betraying in this? How are you, Judas? How is paying with the coin of Judas to enter the circle of any use? Is it just another glorification of Lucifer in the fall and the non servium? What happens after? Or the glorification of Cain for the murder of Abel? Okay, so what? There's rebellion, but like, what happens after that? Is it the glorification of killing, or is it something deeper? So Judas is interesting, not in so much of just that one time-locked thing of the betrayal, but the asking Jesus, like, am I this one? And Jesus saying flat out, like, you're the one that said so. Like, we already know this is going to happen. And everybody else wondering, like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. Who could it be? And
if you think this post is about you, then it might be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if it's not about you, it's not about you. Yeah. Until that, you know, it's about you. Which is, you know, how the occult world works, for sure. Yeah. So I think that that's there's some really lovely things there with Jesus as far as saint And even with the magic attributed to Jesus, and the, we've talked, like you said, about the Arma Christi, the power of place, the holy dowsing that is Helena's, like, just, I'm going to find all the relics. And it's basically, she's walking past somewhere and is like, almost pulls her hand into like an invisible locker and is like, this stone was actually a piece of this saint when they came here years ago and they coughed in this stone. It's like that type of, she was in her, in a whole field day, field lifetime of amazing relics and finding lost places. But either way, how much in the establishment of the church as a historical claim for authenticity that must go through Peter, as opposed through even Paul, right, who never met the historical Jesus. It's about establishing that link to a physical place, to physical people, to historical people, that the emphasis of and part of Western identity is historicity. Like, our legends have to be real to a certain extent for us to claim them as power. And that's, Christianity is the example. It can't be a possible thing happened in the past. No, this happened at this time. We're reframing the whole calendar around it. You know, this
once it's bounded, it can be owned and controlled.
Yes, and the official version sold, and the correct t-shirts that have the copyright on it sold.
Right, right. Yeah. And pointed fingers of non-canonical.
Yeah.
It puts me in mind of that video you sent me of the biblical scholar pointing out that the church precedes scripture, right? That this is oral transmission. And when we talk about the instability or the unreliability of the gospels, and then the greater supposed unreliability of the Apocrypha, which is partly why they're Apocrypha, kind of chicken and egg thing there a tiny bit. But that, like, this makes sense that you're already going off oral transmission. And so to root that in place offers later additional legitimizations and also consolidations of power.
Yeah. And to go off of that clip, it was so beautifully stated, right, is that the Gospels aren't around for quite some time.
Yeah.
And this idea of what is it that allows the Gospels to be codified is people telling stories, is the culture around it, is the Midrashic context, is the things that are not written down. And that cultural envelope and cultural contextualization that was there is, it needs to be understood as part of Christianity, not just a reliance upon the Gospels and the cherry picking of what you liked of how they've been interpreted for 2,000 years.
Yeah, this literalism is far newer than the layers of it. You know, especially in terms of, you know, evangelicalism is a very shallow history.
Yeah. So I guess the short of everything else, like, it's just, I guess, a quick focus on Golgotha for its own kind of lore dump, as it is, as you mentioned, origin of the skull under Golgotha that you see in the iconography when it's a Golgothite cross is Adam's skull. Undoubtedly, this is the skull and crossbones of Adam, the femur bones, which some will equate with the loose bones, meaning the only bone you need to resurrect someone. Sometimes that's a vertebra. Sometimes it's the femur. Sometimes it's some other small bone. Sometimes it's just the skull. But it's this idea that, you know, either the last Adam or the new Adam, there's a New Testament here, right? Like, the old covenant is in the Ark of the Covenant. It's in the understanding of the inheritance of the garden and the people of the garden that God created. But there may have been people created on the previous 6 days, for instance, but they are not God's image. Like, how do you explain the other people in the world? Well, he created other people too.
Yes, which is why one of the semaphores of Adam is to be able to speak with dead men. Which seems to take place before Cain and before Abel's death. Yeah. What's going on there? Yeah. And the idea that, like, demons are also included and the spirits of the winds. So, like, just as, you know, the animals are all said to be vegetarian before the fall. Yeah. So too, like, there's a place for spirits that will later be called demonic.
Yeah. And also, even within that, we're going to talk about Midrashic lore, right? The idea that the world has been created, that this is the third pass around for God.
And this is central to a bunch of some schools of Jewish demonology and exorcism, that, like, these aren't angels that rebelled against God. They're redundant because this is not the first pass and they don't have a job anymore. Yeah, I'll reference again our dear friend, Professor Charles Porterfield, pointing out the understanding that Freudian psychoanalysis is often framed as emergent from a variety of Jewish exorcism practices, which are around talking to this demonic spirit and asking, you know, tell me about your father. How did that make you feel? And supposedly the son of the Dybbuk exorcist becomes a psychoanalyst and the son of the psychoanalyst becomes an exorcist, etc.
Yeah. There's, I think, you know, that as far as the place of the skull and how this goes, and is it the skull-shaped rock? Is it all these things that are now you see, like Easter being descent from Ishtar, right? There's just as much information as there is anything interesting that's about.
Yeah.
But I do find the plant lore, of course, intimately associated with like how the blood falls to the ground and what plants spring up there, whether they're flowers or garlic or any of the number of various things that are attributed to the blood flow of Jesus upon
The
either.
flower of passion,
Yeah.
the passion flower, right?
And the connection to seeing the Arma Christi within those plants or the lore around it, or what is the species of thorns that are used? What are the different things that can be brought to this? Or even New World expressions like when you go to the Jequichiba tree that has these hard casks around it where the seeds are stored, but the seeds look like nails. So the tree becomes associated with Good Friday because it has nails on it, you know, but then natives are making little fetish bundles with these same pods. And so there's just lore around it of like, oh, it's this, that's how syncretism works. It just keeps on taking power, projecting power one way or the other to preserve power, as it were. Through all of that, through the bringing down of the body of Christ with the Pietà type of Mary receiving, you know, the Mother Earth receiving the body of all men type of imagery that goes on there, of the crucifixion itself, especially in like Anglican depictions of having John and Mary on either side of the cross as like the continued inheritors of this Christian legacy of like, you know, woman, there is your son there is your mother, and how that goes to the women of the crucifixion and the waiting period that happens, that it is the women that attend to the tomb. And while this may be traditional, it is also the women who first see the resurrected Christ and carry the news to the apostles. And the place of women within the Christian ministry, although it is not written about as heavily in the Gospels to the extent that you would think for, you know, if it was a truly equal thing, the fact that women are mentioned at all is already against the historical narrative. And to say that he was close to several women is quite profound, and that Mary Magdalene is the first, or Mary of Magdala is the first to, you know, as the gardener that is Jesus in disguise, right? So Jesus kind of, you know, becomes this handyman to kind of let people know, like, do you not recognize me? Stuff going on, which, you know, the apostles and Thomas going through all that too, right? Ver para creer, seeing is believing. But the lore around all of that is beautiful to me. Even in our discussions today of like dead magicians, like there's still a call for me to be of the myrrh bearers, meaning the women and the people associated with the entombment of Jesus. So Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus putting in for 100 pounds of ointment of myrrh to like rub into the body and all these preservation rituals that are used, which brings to mind even our own theme song, which is the Golgothite hymn coming in there, of like a song that is said to be a pharaonic, like pre-Christian melody that is used to wrap and mummify the Pharaoh. And that is transferred to Jesus in the Coptic Church. That the song itself is just a narrative of like the first thing is like Golgotha, which means the skull, and is cranion in Greek. And it goes through different pronunciations and translations of it, but it tells a story of Golgotha in the hymn itself. But this hymn has been sung for 2,000 years and is said to go back further. That the I think part of the beauty and terror of narrative in this way is that it rides the coattails of what has come before it so beautifully. And there's so much there where you get to the women with the bathing of the body, the wrapping and the shroud of pure linen, which wasn't cheap. We know that Joseph of Arimathea is said to have been rich. And by some church traditions, even Mary of Magdala was wealthy in comparison to many others. There's nothing that says she's a whore, but she's a woman of independent means, as it were. And so for a woman to have money, there's only two things: you inherit it or you earned it in a nefarious way. So I think whether Jesus drinking wine mixed with myrrh or vinegar mixed with gall, the idea, because he had said, I will no longer drink of the fruit of the vine, and vinegar still comes from grape in this way of like the rejection of the painkiller or the rejection of the soporific that would ease his pain. The description in the Gospels of the thieves' legs being broken because the Sabbath is the next day and they don't want to have the bodies on the crosses for the Sabbath, because you also can't remove them during the Sabbath, which is a whole other thing. So you want the bodies taken down before sunset, but oftentimes crucifixion takes anywhere from a few hours to a few days. So if you break the legs, they can't push themselves up to take deeper breaths. As they told us wonderfully in Catholic school, probably in like fifth, sixth grade, it's a death by asphyxiation ultimately, because you can no longer hold yourself up and you'll lose your breath. So in addition to being in agony and dehydration and all those things, it is ultimately gasping for air. But then again, that's how all death kind of happens in a way, other than maybe stroke, but like we all die of heart failure at some point. And so just the kind of weird mortification of the flesh fetish that happens out of all of this for Catholics, especially, I'm owning that. But the Western cult of Jesus being so bent up on this like blood flow, arma Christi, whipping, mea culpa, thorns, sweat, blood, blood and water, blood and milk, and myrrh itself, of one of many plants associated with this time period. And I know that myrrh has a special place for you, given that it is kingly, that it is of the Magi.
Yeah.
In addition to this, you know, wine mixed with myrrh, myrrh doesn't have the soporific effect that people have proposed in the past. It's got to be more symbolic or something else, at least the myrrh that we know. So it's, I think there's a complexity there of like, it has backtributions of like why things are done in a certain way. But we know that myrrh itself is bitterness, right? There are several different species, but ultimately is a perfume that is bitter. Go from there. So I'm going to invoke your myrrh knowledge with the king and ask you for, do me justice here. Do it too good.
Oh, yeah. You teed it up. Great. Thank you. Yeah. So I'm told in the etymology of the word itself, it's a Semitic root, which is, myrrh meaning bitter. It is the bitter thing or a bitter thing. That later goes into the Greek and is muron, meaning perfume. And so there is a reference here that it's in the Hebrew Ketoret, the incense of the first and second temple. So there's this play between Jesus's birth religion and the religion that is founded in his works. The pain relief thing made me think that like it's an analgesic. So in theory, there's some pain relief, but you know, to the extent to which it's going to anesthetize being nailed to a cross and asphyxiating to death is like you say, that there's something a little more emblematic there than literal. From what little I know of its use in traditional Chinese medicine, it's a blood mover. And in Ayurvedic medicines, or some Ayurvedic medicines, it's about the circulatory system. And that definitely makes me think about its comparisons with ways in which it is a melancholy ingredient. You know, it's a thing associated with Saturn's heavy shadow. And in my own work, I use it with a lot of working with the virtues and spirits of Tristitia, of the sorrowful, airy figure of European Renaissance geomancy, to ease through periods of mourning, as well as to reinvigorate the heart against melancholy, and for offerings to Saturnine spirits, obviously, as well. But this idea of like helping you both feel your feelings and also ward off or propitiate the things that would hollow you out, the difference between grief and sorrow, and in the Latin dolor, like pain, which can be as spiritual as physical. And all of that, yes, exactly, goes into many of the, well, some of it at least, goes into the understandings of this gift of the Magi, as distinct from the gold of either, you know, the sun or of like actual material, like, hey, here's some money, you're going to need it, you've given birth in a stable, to frankincense and its, you know, the elevating properties of its consecratory materia, to myrrh as, yes, foreshadowing itself as a funerary materia connected to embalming and a variety of other things. It also, you know, doesn't exactly have thorns, but many of its varieties are. The bark gets real kind of rough and spiky. It's definitely not quite into martial territory of full naily thorns, but it's definitely a rough and, I guess, called rude texture to it, and grows in, you know, harsh conditions, and, you know, is regarded as a particularly gnarled tree as well, and is also, you know, not a cheap ingredient necessarily at various points throughout history, and is the little tinge of the sorrows of Mary as well as the joys of Mary, and also, you know, provides, again, the archaeobotanists a way of talking about which king came from where, based on like, well, where was there a lot of myrrh growing, you know, how did he come to be able to source that, to be able to offer it, which again is sometimes tied to the place of origin of the kings, which varies across traditions, just as there are more names than just Caspar, Balthazar, and Melchior. There are other regions that they're all said to be from as well, but in general, always connoting that they're from the furthest reaches or a totality of like whichever continents were known about at the time, that they're meant to represent like a gestalt of all the different wisdoms of humanity coming together to honor this child in the darkness or child of light coming out of the darkness. As well as like a variety of ways in which various material was said to be picked up along the way as well. And this makes me think of the notions of the Rose of Jericho springing up in the road as the Holy Family are fleeing, which I've just been chatting to our friend Phoebe Hildegard, Dr. Finch, who's going to be talking about that at VGS, I believe.
There's quite a few scientific journal reports about the discussion as to whether myrrh or alcohol is the greater analgesic. Between the two, there is citing of a trend that grains of frankincense or myrrh are added to wine to preserve them. So instead of it being adding distilled alcohols we might do today to make a vermouth, that in the heat of the hot weather, that myrrh and frankincense, their antibacterial properties, were a few grains were added to every vessel so that it was hot weather wine, meaning it could be taken out and not stored in cool places the same way.
Preservative.
Yeah, which is its own type of understanding there, that if it was custom, as was said in some other contemporary things, that the goblet of wine containing a grain of frankincense in order to benumb the senses for prisoners led out to execution, and that the wine is ultimately the thing that makes you not care as much. It's just get them drunk and then we can kill them. Also, just
Right.
that myrrh means 40 billion things, right? That there's not only just one genus of all of this, but the opoponax and these other things that we would call by different names now were just as commonly called myrrh. That anything bitter could be called myrrh itself.
Yeah, and again, yeah, it's a bitter thing as well as the bitter thing. That wine preservative is also interesting in terms of the idea of not just anointing a body so it smells nice before you bury it, but also this idea of, from at least like Father Cornelius's lapidary or whatever it is, the Jesuit scholar, talking about how you bury the dead with myrrh to keep them incorrupt, right? And specifically that it dries up moistures, again, the waters of death, and prevents the generation of worms specifically as well. So again, preserving the body of the man who makes water into wine, which again has a Magian link to the wedding at Cana, also being said to happen on a 6th of January and being linked to the blessings of water that seem to have happened far before that and that are still honored in the baptisms of various Eastern Orthodox faiths. But that you are, yeah, preserving the, this is my blood, right, in the wine, as well as, you know, ensuring that whichever corpse you're using to do that with is whole and can therefore be resurrected in body on Judgment Day, as we talked about last episode.
Yeah, absolutely. It's making me think of the various bone reddening recipes in the various witchcraft circles. Pretty sure that, overproof rum and myrrh, mixed maybe with a little madder or something like that, is a pretty common thing. You're going to find a lot of groups of painting the bones red through myrrh tincture, which again prevents the bone from moisture damage. And so it's the reddening, yes, because it harkens back to the color of life, but that reddening of the skull, which at once is both a random skull, but is also the skull of Adam or Abel, which is used to call Cain, ironically, not ironically, but it's interesting that the skull associated with Cain is actually Abel's skull. Then you have the head of John the Baptist in Herodian kind of extension there, which is really a stand-in for kind of Orphic lore and the heads that speak in this way and the various maniac cults that go on. So this skull in various witchcraft circles in the last couple hundred years of being like the reddened skull that is preserved, that is the prophetic skull, that is the head of whatever saint it is by name, that you're kind of, as we've talked about before, like the notion of forcing the saint, that a lot of the kind of necroscopic technology, necroscopic? Necro, ne no? Necromantic? Yeah, there we go. Different thing. Necromantic ideas around the restless dead. I think we did a talk on that many, many, many years ago. Oh, long ago. But the notion that keeping the bones out, like with holy relics, as we talked with Kat too, that keeping the bones in a restless state, that they have to perform a miracle if they want to have any respite.
Yes,
So,
a saint as a tamed or housebroken poltergeist.
yeah. And so the notion of it's not just because they're in heaven, but because there is a torture there, meaning we can then acclaim any relic to any saint or any set of bones specifically, that we can make something act as if it is the saint, which is approaching kind of an Egyptian level of technology, right? Of like, is this statue Anubis or is it a statue that acts as Anubis? And then if something can act as Anubis, is it in his stead? Are we dealing with Home Alone Santa theory, right? Only Santa for the real one. And that you may think you're faking it, but ultimately you're now dressing up as Santa. Santa's going to come for you. You're channeling Santa. That, or sorry if I'm shattering Muddy's illusions about Santa, or that by the nature of parents and even suggesting Santa exists shows that Santa is a spirit that possesses and therefore is a collective belief in Santa that is, passing the buck, blaming, or perhaps early magical inoculations.
Right, Santa is a thing that is done.
Yes.
Right, is a performance of which I know you have many studies. The bone thing also makes me think of a lot of pre-modern Swedish folk magic where you would go and gather a bone from a churchyard and often ask for permission to use it and then use that in the manner in which relics were used. That like any bone in the, not just any saint's bone, but like any bone you can find can be used for a variety of healings from taking injury away by applying it to an afflicted area of the body and then burying it and asking for the disease to be taken to the underworld or to be fed to the dead or to die, as well as a bunch of rites around not reddening, but heating the bone in hot water and making a bone soup, which is interesting because it's not using the bone to transfer a disease away. It's transferring the healing properties from the sacred bone to the water, which is then used to wash the afflicted part of the body. Yeah. Making the bone work for you. And then often replacing it. Along with, you know, Judas's link to the field of blood, there's also supposedly, again, speaking of potential backtributions, there's an etymology proposed around an Aramaic root of Iscariot as the red one as well, interestingly.
Which then brings into mind Adam, right?
Yeah.
Is Adam being tied to flesh colored, to red colored in that way?
Yeah. Not just of the dust, but the red dirt. Yeah.
The infertile dirt.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This is lovely. Okay. Judas, I guess a little bit, you know, like flashing forward of like Judas as demon is like its own thing. Like, yes, we understand the narrative there and even like the potential for syncretization or like the practices in various Latin American folk Catholicisms of treating Judas as he is still apostle and therefore is capable of performing miracles, even if he is also the one who betrayed. And so there's this kind of reliance on the kind of, if it works, it's a saint belief that is pervasive, especially in places like Mexico.
Right. Because otherwise, why would God let it happen?
Exactly. That it's a Catholic universe. And therefore, if Buddha is doing things, then it must be Santo Buddha. And it's the easiest appropriation ever. if this works for you, great. Must be a saint. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Hopefully he'll be a saint for me within the kind of Dante's Inferno kind of thing of Judas being one of the three great traitors that are in the mouth of the devil, right? This is a different perspective here that Judas becomes synonymous with betrayal in the way that Brutus does in that way. And so I think the demonic force there that Judas is so animalistic, so given over to betrayal, he becomes identified so completely with the concept of betrayal that it is impossible to separate him from that.
Right. And having just had the Ides that was coming up again, I saw someone posting, I think it might have been our friend Cadmus, posting that the Et tu, Brute, is not necessarily "and you as well," but a shortening of a phrase that's something about "and you too shall reap what you sow and will know what it's like to be on the end of this dagger, on the business end of it, as well as the stabbing end."
Yeah. It's a lot. And as you said, I think it's Luke that directly talks about Satan entering into Judas, right? So like, is it that Judas is in line? Is it Judas that given over? Is Judas like willfully or unwillfully possessed?
Mm.
Or is it just this is the nature of it, that this is, you know. And this is also interesting because Luke is the most Greek, is the Greek gospel writer here. So there's something here to... yes, to Judas's passions, to Judas calling him out, and the kind of holding Jesus to an ideal of what the popular kind of Catholic, let's teach our children about the interpretation, is going to be that it is the Iscariotes, that it's the belief in a messianic Messiah that would restore the theocracy of Judea, and that they would oust the Romans. Mm-hmm. And that kind of purism was what frustrates Judas, that it doesn't happen. There's also, you'll also see amazing discussions of the Judas gift or the Judas betrayal in discussion of the misappropriation of funds by clergy members that are spending, you know, to that. That is always compared to Judas within the kind of evangelical community too, that there's a scandalousness to that sin that's there and is equally letting Satan in the same way that Judas did. That money could allow this to happen in that way.
Yeah. Again, the fascinating like potential to take it so many different ways, that the polyvalency of Judas's possession, as you say, is it that it wasn't his fault, or that he's a weak link, that there's this like moral nosology that comes up again, that like his previous character failings make him an easier landing pad for a devil to take him over, which you also see in the versions where he doesn't explicitly hang himself, but becomes bloated in life and starts to, his outside reflects his inside in some way, which is obviously has an awful lot of problematic elements to it in terms of normative body types and all sorts of other things like that, and of castigating the people who don't fit a normative, not just beauty standard, but like standard for being considered human, profound othering stuff going on.
Yeah. And it's just some interesting things there, because I know there's, as you said, there's a lot of lore around this. Imagine why. But the notion of if Satan enters Judas, then like how does that help Satan? Like, if Satan is not actually doing the work of God, how does that help Satan when you have now just sped the way towards Jesus's resurrection and the elimination of death?
And the supposed salvation of all peoples.
Yeah, so it's a and constant fulfillment of scripture, right? That's why Jesus is pierced and not his legs aren't broken like the thieves, right? Because you can't break bones in this and fulfill scripture. So it's a lot of the gospel narrative is meant to flag people that know scripture well, especially Matthew, because hearkening back to prophets. He's necromantically fulfilling and validating Jesus, which is, you know, if tradition is the democracy of the dead, as it were, as has been lovingly quoted, misquoted, and paraphrased. I'm just trying to think of anything else. I mean, you have, like, I was thinking about the replacement of Judas and the kind of drawing a straw Judas through the town, or a dummy of Judas that is used as kind of a Catholic version of the scapegoat. Is done in many towns, many places. I know it's done in Latin America in various places. I know it's done in Europe in various places. I've read that, for instance, amongst certain Slavic populations, that it is known that the burning of Judas was specifically introduced to dissuade people from the burning of Morana and the pagan idols and the getting rid of winter and going into spring. And so Judas's straw body that gets hung from the church belfry, or that gets brought through the town, and these other things where people beat it. But also the pyre burning of Judas that can happen even in Middle America with, like, Judas bonfire nights of, like, this is what happens before Easter. Of, like, we heap our disgust and the things we want to get rid of onto this Judas. Or even that I know from various friends who grew up in certain areas that dressing a dummy, a straw dummy, in the clothes, the uniform of your rival school, and then beating him as it's dragged through the area and then, like, set on a bonfire on, like, the football field of
wow. Nothing burns called, like, an effigy.
Yeah, still calls as Judas. It's still called Judas. Wow. Like, the dummy itself is called Judas, whether or not there's any religious symbolism added to it. So it's just this notion of, like, the effigy itself is quite interesting there. The iconography, in addition to the kiss that's there, he's often depicted as a yellow or a redhead, and it's, like, the kind of blonde that happens with it, which echoes fox fur, supposedly, like, very specifically, which is coding it for being that demon, as it were, or the kind of slyness of the fox.
Right, the trickster.
Otherwise, he might be very hirsute and echo, like, a bear or a boar. So between the fox, the bear, and the boar, and how inextricably linked the cat is to Judas, that the cat is a personal totem, because cats themselves are not loyal like dogs. They set out on their own and do other things. And so there might be a dog near Jesus, especially near disciples like John. But Judas is also linked to the cat itself in many paintings. That villains were shown in profile, I always thought was interesting. Then a lot of the depictions of the Last Supper, if you see Judas, he's in profile, so that you know it's him. Three quarters profile, not so much. But that's not always the case, because, you know, conventions of how things are depicted are one. But there's a beautiful Rubens painting that is the Last Supper, where everyone is looking at Jesus during the transubstantiation of, like, you know, this is my body, eat of my body. And Judas is looking at the camera, as it were. Oh. He's the observer, like, biting his nails. He also has a dog under his feet. So it's like, there goes the loyalty notion. But I guess to have a dog under the table of the master is quite telling. But the fact that Judas is breaking the fourth wall, and that's mid 17th century, so that's, like, that's quite profound, I think. For him to, like, look towards the viewer in that way. And then also, you have to, I think that in addition to, like, yes, Last Temptation of Christ and all these other things that kind of change the Jesus narrative, I really do think that, for better or worse, Andrew Lloyd Webber's Jesus Christ Superstar changes the figure of Judas hugely, where he's very, still very serious, but he's still the most rational and pragmatic of the followers of Jesus, trying to hold everybody to the rules that Jesus has set. And that there is, even after the betrayal, he recognizes himself and emphasizes to the audience that he is the tool by which Jesus is delivered, that everyone has a role to play. And so I think that there's giving it more than just the villain role in that way is quite interesting. In that, it's not my having had to listen to it every Easter in Catholic school, like, there was like, we're gonna listen to this. I was like, I'm good. I mean, like, I like a couple songs. Give me some Mary Magdalene all day long. But I also loved it. I think I saw the first time I saw it live, like a national touring. It was one of the original Jesuses. I think it was Ted Neely. So he's old at this point. He's in his, you know, It's an older gentleman playing the young Jesus. And when he goes to the temple and loses his temper, it was inflatable Jesuses that he was stabbing, which was obviously a commentary on, you know, like modern states of religion and things like that. But it was still very funny. And then after Jesus dies, he resurrects, right? He, like, the, you know, Jesus kind of floats up into the rafters.
Yeah.
But because of the size of the stage, his feet were still visible while everyone was taking the curtain call, which was, I don't know. It was fascinating, this kind of regional tour of Jesus Christ Superstar. Yeah. Other than that, I think the notion, like, I think, is it Swedish, right? The Easter witches, that when Jesus has the Passover meal, right, on Thursday night, and that when he's betrayed, that according to popular beliefs, all evil is released when Jesus was sentenced to be crucified. Oh. So the night of Maundy Thursday is considered witch night. And these are when witches fly to, is it, I can't, my pronunciation is terrible, Blakula, to celebrate the devil on Maundy Thursday.
The Maundy witches, yeah.
So this is to ward off witches, to light fires, shoot off fireworks, make sure the fireplace is blaring, you know, get everything. And the notion of witches coming down the chimney is always fascinating to me, right? That it is the drafts that go. And having played with fireplaces recently a lot, that it has to be 20 degrees different for the fireplace to really get that draft to pull the smoke up. So, like, if it's not, it has to be warm enough inside to make it more warm inside. Like, it's going to be smoky until there's a difference between outside and inside temperatures. And then it will pull the smoke up, which gets very magical when you see it, right? Because you're like, it just sucked it up. But I guess this notion of with the Easter, which is fascinating to me, and just the different lore around this, that there are ways to, within the Garden of Gethsemane, like the Spanish recipes, where you can force a decision by doing certain herbs that are gathered that night, that you can put someone through the miracle of Christian time travel, kind of the pains of the Via Dolorosa, through 30 pieces of silver, and understanding how to use their baptismal name and their guardian angel, and to capture it in that way through trial. So anyway, heretical Christian magic, woohoo! not just there to command angels, but really to empower witches. Yeah, okay. Place of place, but we've gotten a good amount of dead magician, Golgotha lore, Judas, some myrrh going in there. Was I thinking with myrrh? If one, it's just, it smells good. Tincture of myrrh itself is used medicinally, as you said. Like, it is an analgesic. It's just the question of, like, one gospel account mentions it specifically and one doesn't. And how does that go? And what does that mean? That too much myrrh in there, like a medicinal dose of myrrh, we wouldn't drink it anyway. It would taste terrible.
Right.
That said, the crucifixion lore that includes the Holy Grail, one of the substances of the Holy Grail itself is emerald. And we were talking recently, and I think that was what kind of shocked me, is that there are only 4 precious stones. I did not know this. We talk about semi-precious, but it's fascinating to bring to account, like, well, what about the actual preciousness of things? That there is, precious stones are the big 4, right? Diamonds, rubies, sapphires, and emeralds. And we've done the others on the show, I believe, but we have not done emeralds. So
from the red inning to the green inning.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, I think Bloodstone was one of the first ones to do. And the weirdness between those two things, right? That, as you're saying here, like the green inning of, like, emerald is tied to things that grow. Like, that's just its name in most languages is tied to this, green itself being tied to this notion of growing things, the color of plants, that it, Smaragdos is ultimately perhaps a Persian term that enters into different Semitic languages as well as Greek, which then becomes Smaragdos in Latin. And this eventually becomes Esmeralda, Esmeraldus, which is very, like, if you have Spanish friends, we're going to put an E in front of S words, just how it is. So the somehow that Esmeralda becomes emerald, you know, from Smaragdos or Smardina, when you talk about, like, the tablet of Hermes. So etymology is what it is, but it's fascinating that the gemstone has such an identity that it is a fairly detailed and specific etymology that we can trace, as opposed to some gems are less so. Some plants are definitely less so, but it's a cinnamon amongst stones. my babbling. But it's, you know, beryl, it's green beryl. It's 7.58 on the Mohs scale, but it's also just fucking pretty. As a green fan, I know that, you know, but as someone who finds green wonderful to stare at, there's a lot of lore around emerald. Yes, the color, the clarity, and all that type of good stuff. But you were saying that you had some from the specific Laughdary?
Yeah. The Leonardi Speculum Lapidum translation by Liliana Lepodi that Penn State put out. Yes. And that fills in a lot of the, not holes exactly, but like shows how other later lapidaries, like say the Peterborough lapidary, kind of where they're getting a lot of their stuff from, and makes it make a lot more sense. Links, yes, to greenness, to sight, both as scrying and also, like, as you're saying, like the quality of just gazing at it is said to be therapeutic or medicinal, linked to purity as well. And also some links to griffins as well, which are, you know, a favorite beast of mine. Yeah. So the Peterborough lapidary says it is a stone that surpasses all the greenness of green things. It is the greenest thing. It is that which we judge green by. How close or far is it from emerald? And this is partly, yes, because of its great beauty. Also because there's a lot of stuff about how it colors the air. It said that he infects the atmosphere around him with his surpassing green color. From him comes a beam that dyes the air around him and makes him green. So there's this notion of, like, just as the magnet is this kind of text example of sympathetic and antipathetic action, so emerald becomes this like go-to of contagion or exposure, depending on what you want to call that principle. And it's the Speculum Lapidum that says that it placed under the light or rays of the sun, it does not dim, which some stones do. Rather, its green is intensified in strength in the colors and colors the surrounding air with his hue. So we have this idea of it being the very thing that is most obviously radiating because it's making everything else like it. So you've got an understanding of action at a distance again. So another kind of sympathy as opposed to attraction or like Empedoclean love as it gets translated. You have this notion of, like, that's how Roger Bacon talks about action at a distance, that it can flavor the part, that can flavor the air, that then flavors the air next to that air, that then flavors the air next to that air, and like, transmits as well. And that has a bunch of different consequences. It says that no gem delights the eyes as much, and as such it's said to be a sovereign remedy for the sight to behold, both in terms of sharpening the eyes, literally sharpening sight. It saves and comforts feeble sight. Whoever bears it, even not just looking at it but just having it, it's said that their sight won't fail them, as well as specifically comforting, like, again, a little mer connection. It's said to specifically comfort the eyes that grieve as well. So the greening is a balm to grief and out the other side through it. It's also, obviously, because we're talking about sight and sight beyond sight, there are lots of myths around its being used to scry. It's said that Nero has a mirror of this stone in which he looked and knew by the virtues of this stone all that he sought or desired. The Speculum Lapidum actually specifically says that Nero would watch gladiators fighting through it. And that's sometimes also linked to Caesar supposedly seeing the fighting of swordsmen abroad in the stone. So it's also this sense of like remote viewing of the battles that are going on, so that the central authority can see what's happening on the outskirts of where empire meets those that don't want to be empire. It's also said to reveal figures, images and shapes of things that are near to it. So it's also a detection stone as well of various sorts, not just in terms of the visions you see in it, but also how it activates the atmosphere around it and the environment around it. It's said to help those who are accustomed to divine and guess what will befall, either directly by looking into it or just, again, empowering other kinds of divination or prognostication. There's all sorts of stuff around its, as you say, its preciousness as well. It's both said to be the most Dioscorides, probably citing Isidore, says that it's the most precious of green stones, or just the most precious of stones in other translations. And that it also itself increases riches. It's said to increase wealth quite often. There's a link back to some Edenic greens as well. It's often held that emerald comes out of the land of Tyre, by a river of paradise, and that many of the rivers of Eden are named by the copper that's said to come from it, or in one case the emerald, and that this is also where sometimes the griffins come in, that they, just like they're said to guard gold, they're also sometimes said to keep the emeralds of the river of paradise in the land of Syria, and they're said to like battle cyclopses for the emeralds on the river itself. Oh yeah, along with, so this other prognostication angle is interesting in that it links to something we've talked about before, which is the idea of like there's the empowerment of like knowing things more easily, like the clarity of your predictions, the clarity of your seeing what's going to happen. But then also it's a boost to your words when you are describing what's going to happen, right? So it says, in some cases, it says it makes your words feared. It makes men have good and fair words. So it makes us more truthful, I guess. And the evidence of and cause of pleas. And the Speculum Lapidum actually fills that in. And it says that it lends strength to the arguments of rhetoricians. and it is useful for them, for they worry about foreknowledge of future cases. So this idea of like, don't just make my sight more accurate, make it so that what I say does happen as well. And less of a causal nature there, but ensuring that our predictions are not just things that we see or know, but can transmit.
Yes, that sounds good. I like that. I've been re-diving into Charabel a lot recently because I'm also speaking at the DGS on Spiritism. And although Charabel, he doesn't not self-identify as a Spiritist, but I think it's impossible to separate the entirety of the occult revival away from spiritualism. It lays the groundwork. But Charabel, if listeners are not familiar, he wrote the Grimoire Sympathia is how it's known now. That is not its original name by any means, but it is an interesting grimoire because it is, if you are familiar with Viridarium Umbris by Schilke, you will recognize some impulses here whereby substances have sigils and prayers and secret names. So Charabel is John Thomas. He's a Welsh mystic that is a clairvoyant. He's a healer. He's an occultist. And he's going around the spiritualist community doing lectures and healings in this way. He took the name Charabel. He is probably more known for his astrological footprint, the degrees of the zodiac symbolized that he wrote with Safariel, who's Dr. Walter Old. But there's this other book that he wrote that is, again, now known by the name Grimoire Sympathia. But his entry on emerald specifically, because he does go, most people associate with plants, and he's going through like divine communication with these plants and their spirits and using the names, the divine names that he receives from them as a way of activating them, forming alliances and practicing with them so that you don't even necessarily need these plants around once you've incorporated their energy and understanding of how these plants operate.
Yeah.
But the sigil is, which is going to be on the artwork for this episode, because why not? But Amvradel is the name of Emerald in this divine tongue that he has. It's the divine name there. But he associates that Emerald is the stone of Judah on the breastplate, and therefore is the entire inheritance of, by extension there, of the Jewish people. But that the Judah itself represents all things that are plentiful, kingly, messianic. And that since Emerald is so enraptured with like fertility and rebirth, because it is the garden, right? This whole point of returning to the garden that is there. By this blessing, you'll find the notes. They're cheating. Divine wisdom, holy joy, benevolence of heart, and a hungering and thirsting for celestial communion. A renewal of your physical strength through the soul world, and a possibility of attaining to blessed immortality is all contained within Emerald. And the prayer that he gives, because like, why not go into these interesting prayers? Amvradel, thou father and mother, one divine, thou source of all power, which with beauty combine, earth's offspring of verdure, the first growth on this sod, thou jewel of Judah and thou gem of the God, deep down in the earth or the depths of the sea, wherever Amvradel thy body may be, my soul in sympathy with thee will be joined. In physical searching thy soul self I shall find. Hold up thou my life, thou of beauty the model. Give me thy glory and thy wisdom, Amvradel. So it's a prayer to the emerald in this lovely Welsh mystic's personal grimoire of plant and stone spirits, which I highly think is fun to understand how these things get recycled every so often. It's not stated as such, which is interesting for Schilke to not state the direct influence as such, but it is obviously an influence on Viridarium Umbris specifically, with a tree, for instance, being highlighted in each chapter with a sigil, with a secret name, and with a prayer invocation that speaks to the metaphysics around that plant.
Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, hi Charabel, I'm gonna keep putting your name out there. I love the time encapsulation, right? Like it definitely feels like early 1900s, like kind of a weird universalism that's being asked for, but it's still in its democratized universalism of like anybody has the ability to come up with this through direct contact with the divine. And I think that's one of the beautiful parts of spiritualism before we get to like the potential for fraudery and all these other things, that the homegrown spiritism is ultimately about putting divine's power in your hands so that you can actually interact with God and holiness directly, as opposed to have to rely on the church, have to rely on interpretations. And that, you know, although there's some conflicts between the official rules of spiritism and spiritualism and how it was practiced on a daily basis, I think this is a prime example of like someone who's trying to use their channeling and understanding of spirits and how spirits work to benefit others so that they can access these things ultimately for healing.
Yeah.
Healing in the holistic sense, like we talk about, of like healing poverty, healing loneliness, healing physical ailments. This is all part of the glory of God. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. A healing misconception as well, right? Like
yes.
healing the wounds to truth.
That bringing us back to the garden, right? That this mm-hmm. is ultimately the kind of hope here. And emerald within this capacity is the Jannah. It is the Edenic stone. Yeah. This is the promise of it. It's that he specifically brings up with emerald the relationship with light. That it is when God says, let there be light, that it the earthly reflection of heavenly light, as I'm a big fan of, is in green. And so the color of the emerald is the child, the firstborn child of the mystic color purple, if I remember him correctly. Mm. That it is a direct echo of God's specialness in an earthly form, that plants trap sunlight as green and are a benefit to us, that we who were vegetarians, we who were in the garden in a different state without death. So it's, yeah, good stuff. Not a standard lapidary by any means, and certainly doesn't have tons of stones in here. They're mostly like the breastplate stones, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Or the said to be breastplate stones.
Right, of which emerald is usually said to be the third when they bother like bother when a particular sequence is given. It's often said to be a third of Aaron's breastplate. Yeah.
But yeah, so all those things to say, whether we go into like, and the green light that echoes there within Sufism and the green body of light as being the closest to the immortal, and you can invoke a little bit of Qurban and, you know, the building the body of light mythos that we go to Sufism as being green, as, you know, Khidir, as we talked about with Jay.
Yeah.
And this notion that everything is connected to that emerald, that the emerald tablet of Hermes, right? That the Holy Grail here itself being a form of emerald, or that emerald is the stone in the crown of Lucifer, and which is also then felt to be a nod towards Moldavite by people that want to attribute more, even more lore to Moldavite. the buzzing emerald of Lucifer himself.
Yeah.
Judas Iscariot is Tradcraft Witch Saint. Yes, that's there. Emerald as Child of Purple. Yes. Okay. Good. All right. We're hitting it all. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
I guess sacrifice is the major big theme because, like, we, you know, I think sun lore is great. And please feel free to interject and put things in.
Yeah, no, I think we need to talk about sacrifice at this point, definitely. Yeah. If we're talking about like the light that is a reflection of heavenly things, you know, the idea of, again, to start, as we often do with the etymology, like sacrifice from the Latin sacrificium, to make sacred, right? From facere, right? To make, and sacer meaning to, often said to mean to set something apart, and by implication from the secular or the profane, for the use of, again, from some people with some particular ideologies, the idea of making it separate from the profane for the use of, quote, supernatural powers. But this idea of setting apart is interesting, right? Whether we're talking about giving something to a spirit that's now not yours, that an offering is a kind of sacrifice, that the giving them something that they now own or now can transmit their blessings through, or just to feed them in some way, to giving something up, to putting it out of the reach of mortal hands.
Yeah, I think this notion of sacrifice is quite interesting. Like, what is the part that keeps things going? Like, obviously talking about blood sacrifice here within the, you know, invoking Hebrews chapter 9, and Guide Catholic School is embedded it into me, that the idea that Jesus is the last blood sacrifice needed for Christians.
Right.
I would like to invoke the history of war and pillaging on top of that. The nonviolence of the early Christians would be nice to listen to. But that aside, that the notion of blood sacrifice is not, it is depicted in popular media and otherwise of being like this wanton, like just blood splatters everywhere. And it's about the gore of the act, as opposed to those peoples that eat meat. Let's do something with this to assuage the guilt of killing, to assuage the slaughter and the heaviness that is associated with death,
yeah,
is ultimately we see as an impulse for behind a lot of what animal sacrifice ultimately is, that you can give that job to just butchers, or you can pray and you can make the animal's death a holy act whereby you're either invoking God or blaming a God, or at least passing the buck to this is how the community survives. And you try and develop ways of doing it quickly so that the blood can be used to consecrate perhaps, or to at least be in service of the larger community, and that the meat is then communion with people.
Yeah, that it feeds the community. And this division between the blood for the community of spirits you're working with and the meat for the people that just, you know, did a bunch of work.
And so I think there's an interesting, it would be lovely if we could, I mean, I don't want to assume that that's all forms of animal sacrifice throughout history that do this, but when we talk about sacrificing an animal for a deity, we have plenty of examples in contemporary practice where that is the case. And to assume that that's not the case by and large, when it seems to be the case with those traditions that still have animal sacrifice intact, because most traditions did at some point. I don't want to say that that is the only reason that people do it. I'm sure that there is a mindset where bloody offerings and gore is part of it, that we know that there are cults like that, but we can't necessarily trust the narrative when you're talking about descriptions of cultic practice that are always from the point of view of someone trying to rally money or support to go conquer something. So that demonization of sacrifice in that way. I also think it's funny how I'm just as set about what I think definitions are, but I understand the misuse and the growth of how words work. But the difference between a shrine and an altar, and specifically altar as opposed to ER, that an altar is where sacrifice is made. So offerings are made at an altar, as opposed to a shrine, which is an altar is a type of shrine, but there is a difference there. And that, like, an ultra-Catholic point of view is that the high Protestants and Catholics and Eastern Orthodox still have the sacrifice of the Mass, the offering of the gifts of bread and wine. And therefore, it is an altar. It is not an altar if there is no communion, if there is no sacrifice actually being made. Mm. And that is in line with, like, especially when you get into the going more Golgothite things there, that the linen that is on the cloth of the altar in Catholicism is meant to be as Jesus's burial shroud. That is why it has to be linen. And that you are basically performing the Mass over a memory of the dead body, by which in the middle of the altar is a relic of a saint that is now in contact with Jesus somehow, because the saint has been proven to be in heaven and performing miracles.
Right.
So there's this constant reliance on the contagion of miracle, the contagion of divine light, the contagion of the dead here, going back to Jesus and his lineage, you know, the lineage of David, yay, Jesse, and other such things there. I think I was just saying this story to Sarah earlier, because, you know, I think it's at the beginning of Little Buddha with Keanu Reeves, where the story is told of a Brahmin priest who is about to offer a goat to some deity, and the goat starts laughing, and the priest says, "Little goat, why are you laughing?" And the goat says, "Because after 10,000 lifetimes as a goat, I will be born human in my next lifetime." Mm-hmm. And then the Brahmin is like, "Well, then it is good that I can help facilitate this for you, and I wish you well on your journey." And he starts to reach for the knife again, and the goat starts crying, and he says, "Little goat, why are you crying?" And the goat says, 10,000 lifetimes ago, I was a Brahmin. so it's just a notice there of, like, the jab in the sacrifice theories there, but also that in some cosmologies, and we see hints of this in various West African and Central African cosmologies, that the very act of sacrificing actually makes the animal more likely to be human in its next lives, that the population increase and souls coming into us, that not every soul is a reincarnation of previous ancestors, that sometimes new souls emerge, and that these are sometimes from the natural world, yeah, and that they have garnered a certain amount of humanity. Or that similarly, I guess, from, like, the sacred feast in Tibetan Buddhism, right, where you're disposing of ritual offerings that have been consecrated to the lamas that are present and not present, and these deity offerings, that when you dispose of those to nature, that especially where birds can get it, because birds are considered so high in the chain of being because they fly,
yeah,
but that increases the likelihood that bird or that those animals will start to achieve the highest levels of consciousness within their specific bodies and lead them on a chain to where they can attain the preciousness of the human body.
Right. They're given more agency.
Yeah. And so, like, it's the type of thing that, you know, the meat that might be used in a tantric feast like this, that a tiger comes along, and that tiger somehow, in its introduction to eating this meat, it's somehow within its tiger nature, not going outside of its tiger nature completely, but refuses to kill for sport, or doesn't kill things it doesn't need to eat for its family, is already very different than how tigers might normally operate. And so it's that kind of, what can that progression be in that way, which I think is all tied into the notion of sacrifice, the transformative power of sacrifice in these various ways, regardless of the opinions on meat or not, right? We know what's the shorthand of it is that the Buddha died choking on a pork sandwich. but I think about the notions of sacrifice in the traditions that we're knowledgeable in. I remember bugging Cadmus about this recently, of like, there is an increasing folk practice within Greek polytheism of digging pits for the chthonic deities, but we don't have as much archaeological reference of those things. It's hard to know if those pits were, as described, were really for ritual reasons, or whether or not they were practical reasons, like drainage ditches within these temples and things like that.
Right.
But that whether or not it was a historical practice 2,000 years ago, there are modern pagan groups that are using this method of appeasing chthonic deities through pit sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And you see it in, like, as far as like invoking and necromantically calling the dead through pit sacrifice. But how common is it to dig a hole and place the offerings and bury it, mm-hmm. as opposed to constantly burning things for the Olympian gods and a little bit of portion of all those things? But I find the pit offerings very interesting specifically, or how sacrifice sometimes does demand very specific things. And you think of classic witches' spells where, like, certain actions that an ingredient for a spell might be seven lies and one truth. And that this is very fey influence, like magic there, right? Like that, those are tangible. Mm-hmm. That the act of theft, that you, a thief, now how you are a thief. You mm-hmm. stole something that, you know, that anything, you know, it's the... It reminds me, this is all tangential, I apologize, but like when you need brothel dirt or something like this, that you don't know where a brothel is, but you know where the ladies of the night hang out. So you go and you pay them, I'll give you $10 to go grab a bunch of dirt for me. Yeah. And like, that is the next closest thing, that contagion through veneria, right? Yeah. And, you know, we were joking earlier about the propane torch and the heating of things to make things to powders. But like, if you can't conjure the flames of hell, store-bought will do just fine.
Right.
But yeah, so I think the nature of sacrifice itself is quite interesting in the larger context here, that the animal sacrifice that was so prevalent in the temple, even through the Jesus lifetime period, mm-hmm. of having to bring doves to cleanse women after their 40 days of repurification after giving birth, or when a couple is marrying to come offer something to the temple. The temple was the dwelling place of the Jewish deity.
Right.
And that notion that sacrifice is owed, that it is a tithe. Mm-hmm. You must allot a certain amount of your success and make sure that it goes to that, which also feeds, of course, the temple priests. And this notion of warehouses that store so much is tied to, let's say, like Karen Armstrong. People should take shots when I mention her name. But talking about how there's no understanding of what a priest is in Mesopotamian religion. It's always tied to the rulers of the city. That there's this temple that's a warehouse that stores the excess grains, that stores the offerings, which are then allotted as needed, but are there mainly to make sure that the upper class has their storage piles. Yeah. And that, you know, even in that mythology, that there are the gods, the great gods created the lesser gods, meaning the stars that set to do their work, and that those gods created humans to be like, we don't want to slave away like this.
Right. Surplus value comes back into play, right?
Yeah, it's all pyramid theory still again, you know, trickle mm-hmm. down or trickle up. And that's all tied to the nature of sacrifice there. I think about, there's that one Frida Kahlo painting of her head on a deer with the arrows going into her. I was obsessed with this a lot as a kid. And the question of like, what is the sacrifice? And the deer tying in here is just my little Mexican brain going over. There's a proverb associated with the deer in Mexican Loteria that is el venado no ve nada, which is the male deer, el venado. No ve nada means not the doe, but no ve nada means sees nothing. So the boy deer sees nothing, or the boy deer, not the doe deer. And I like the pun of that shit. Like that's the type of pun I love to. Yes. And I thought about that all the time, looking at that painting and the notion of what is a sacrifice and what is it to walk into something where you know you will be sacrificing something. And our romanticization of that through our Western culture and the inheritance of Christianity, of that you have to suffer for your art. As opposed to suffering makes your art better, but it doesn't mean you have to suffer. Like, or it can if you treat it a certain way.
Right.
But like this notion that magicians and spirit professions are by their nature tainted because they're taking money for something that should be free. I'm sorry. Did you spend 20 years researching this? And now you're asking for opinion on something? How is that different than like getting an interior decorator or going to a doctor in that way of like specialized knowledge sets or specialized knowledge sets?
Yeah.
But it's tied into this notion of what used to be about making things sacred. You know, cue that scene in Rome where they kill the bull and they're just gossiping underneath the grate. Mm. They kill the bull and the blood of the bull just drips down on them and they keep talking. Or the idea that you have to sacrifice, that you have to go without as the holy person, you know, that this is your job, that you have to be Jesus. It's like, I didn't realize that was my birthright. But
yeah, it feels like an inheritance of some disenchantment to be like, no, 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 but that kind of labor is different because it's, again, supernatural, beyond the normal laws, as opposed to, you know, dealing with the natural magic of the world.
And also the idea of like to sacrifice a little to then get a lot, that then you're going to sacrifice part of what you got as well. So like you make a small offering to be like, if you do this for me, I'll give you part of whatever comes.
And right, that, gratitude.
Yeah. That, well, that's the nice word for it. bribery and indulgences and all these. I don't know. It's interesting. The offering there of, here's a small thing. If you give me this larger thing, like I'll come back and I'll do these two things or these three things for you. Right. And the stories within our culture and many cultures of the dangers when you don't follow through with that.
Mm.
Even within a Christian context, right? It's not always just the bad other weird religions that aren't the Abrahamic face or, you know, conveniently over-philosophized into Western Buddhism and yoga Hinduism. Yeah.
Yeah, it's both very present, right? You get animal sacrifice referenced as an offering to a spirit in certain Grimoric stuff. But then there's also a lot of folk traditions of, you know, offering an animal that's been baptized with a human name to a or the devil as well. And so there's this element of like trickery there, as well as like a victory over the forces of evil in some sense, that you've walked away ahead of the deal.
Yeah, makes me think of something. My brain just farted. I have sacrificed my brain on the altar of time many times in many lifetimes. Sacrifice itself is a notion that it's so easy to justify and kind of intellectualize our way out of it through metaphor and through the kind of passing of physical sacrifice or things that actually make us suffer. I think about the sacrifices of Lent, and like the abstaining from things is viewed as like a huge sacrifice. Like, why would I sacrifice my comfort? Like we're talking about hair shirts and burlap shirts and walking on your knees to a church and things like that. And right. Now modern day, like, I would never do that. This is terrible. How dare you ask me these things? Is it necessary? Like, but what is it that, you know, at its heart, like, what is it that makes you things sacred for you? I don't know. Like, what is this?
Is it the glorification of self-mortification? Is it the glorification of suffering? Or is it finding a way to learn lessons from it and to build towards, you know, less total suffering through having been inoculated by it?
I mean, yes and, Al. Yes and.
Get to.
Yeah. Catholicism runs deep. I also think, and I really hope Ben will come on sometime, but I would love to talk and the notions there of like using meditative devices to take the place of animal sacrifice, but where you were visualizing your own dismemberment and offering your body to gods, demons, and otherwise to satiate the hungers of the world, and then returning to your consciousness afterwards. Now, did you actually sacrifice yourself? I mean, you sacrificed some time at least, but the idea of the visualization process itself there is that it is as good as offering these things, that you can make of your body a nectar that will satiate the devil. This is how you can help with epidemics and harsh environments and strong emotions, is to feed the people that are exhibiting those things, to feed the disease itself, to like, what is it that you need? Well, let me feed it to you. I'll give you my identity and my body. I think there's something really beautiful to that notion of sacrifice as well. You know, the sacrifice or the silencing of our own waiting to speak when listening to someone is an incredibly beautiful, powerful sacrifice, right? How difficult it can be to just listen to someone when you want to speak as well. And the whole, the listening tongue that's proposed in modern yoga of like, put your tongue flat on the bottom of your mouth and don't have it poised in a position ready to speak the whole time when you're listening. Mm-hmm. So apparently I'm both bemoaning non-physical actual sacrifice, but also condoning it. So welcome to the contradictions that are.
Why not both?
Yeah. Why not both? Welcome. Yeah. ¿Por qué no los dos? Good run on the sacrifice.
Yeah.
As far as I guess the transition in there and how it reminds me of Letizia and things that we've talked about, is the kind of the notion of keeping the ball aloft, of keeping the flame of joy alive, takes sacrifice. You have to get up and tend to it. If this corresponding energy within the kind of corpus of Odu is always talked about as good for business, but I understand that you have to wake up and see how you can shift things around, what you can do, how you're going to paint the old thing to make it new again. It takes energy to play the volleyball of joy. And I think that that's its own sacrifice, right? That, like, you know, oh, what's it just in? Oh, this is just it, because you want to sell the thing that's been on the shelf for 4 months. So, like, here it is. It's amazing. It's special. It's the last one. And can you do that ethically is a whole other question I have that I obviously, I think that you can. I think it's much harder, of course.
Right. Well, there's a sense of how do you communicate the value of something, right? And obviously that can include inflating it and lying about it, but it can also include meeting people halfway on the bridge of communication and being able to explain better why it would be a benefit for someone. Yeah, that refreshment is not just about putting, you know, bullshit in a fancy suit, but also literally like rejuvenating the understanding of a thing and rejuvenating yourself and your pursuits and your sacrifice of time and effort. And yeah, and engagement with the thing. I think about the times arrow of this as well, that you are, yes, if Laetitia is fiery, as in more Arabic sources, you know, you're putting it in a different light. You're allowing a spark to be carried forth from the embers to start a new fire. In more European sources, Laetitia is often a watery geomantic figure, which seems in part to fit in with it being usually associated with Jupiter and therefore the planetary domicile of Pisces in some case. But the babbling brook makes a lot of sense to me, or even, you know, rivers that one cannot step in the same part twice, that there is this refreshment and rejuvenation that's at the core of it. But this idea of time's arrow being that the joy is fleeting, that it's a mobile figure, right? However you elementize it, that it's pointing away from us if we see it on the table. The pointy end is rocketing off the ball of communication. You know, the volleyball is kept aloft in this arc, which itself is linked to the jaw that continues to speak, that joy comes from honest and open communication, or, you know, babbling excitedly like so many brooks, but that it is kept aloft by our efforts, and that these are the efforts that elevate and rejuvenate, which also gives us this, you know, there's a bunch of stuff to that, right? Like, so it makes me think of Keats talking about bursting joy's grape upon the palate, right? That in experiencing it has already happened, it is passing. And the moment we're like, oh, I am eating a grape, you are interrupting the sensation and the phenomenology of what the grape is doing. As well as passion itself, passio being not just to suffer, but also that which moves us and moves through us, that the sanguine heart experiences joy and sorrow and is moved to tears quickly and then moves through them. And that the melancholy heart is one that holds on to things and gets clogged up because it doesn't process stuff. It is not expressed. It doesn't pass through us and it doesn't ripple out. And that joy gets to be the thing that lights others' fires or ripples out and soothes other and keeps other waters fresh, right? And this idea of rejuvenation and refreshment is, I think, really essential, a feeling a little bit new. Again, not hopefully in a escapism way, although, again, Tolkien talking about escapism is the job of a prisoner of war. Like, and we're meant to look for other horizons when the ones that we have are oppressive or harmful. And there are notions within, you know, the idea of joy as a passion being a little singular in pre-modern European psychology, emotion theory, humoral theory, around it being not just a sensation of the body, not just carnal joy, but of spiritual joy is kind of isolated from the others, a little bit like love, I guess, in the sense of having this capacity to ennoble us and elevate us. But it is it too, joy like inspiration, to butcher that quote, must also like find us working, right? That it's not just going to sit there. That's what melancholy does, right? And thinking in a via negativa, or I guess a Laetitia negativa, like Laetitia joy, you know, 1, 2, 2, 2, he said, testing the mic and also hopefully spelling out the form of the figure. It's upside down is tristitia. It is not sorrow, right? Though there's a close relationship, right, in chasing and surprising each other as they might chase or cycle around each other. And it brings to mind the Khalil Gibran proclamation about, like, the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. And I was going back over that quote again, and the two examples he gives in this hollowing/hallowing, wine and music, which are both kind of pretty, especially Laetitian. He asks, you know, is not the cup that holds your wine the very cup that was burned in the potter's oven? And is not the lute that soothed your spirit the very wood that was hollowed with knives? and this kind of hollowness of Tristitia being countered with the heights of Laetitia's kind of tower or wedding arch or new beginning or newness in ourselves, or just the trust that if we bat that honest communication to someone else, that they'll bat it back.
Yeah, it's interesting within the kind of use of the figure within Bantu Angola, Kanale, you know, framework of acknowledging that the head is active here, but the heart and the gut and the feet are lacking. And as medicine, it's the commitment to renewal is not something that you can, like, your heart should be in it to motivate you, but it takes such maintenance that it does not matter if your heart and gut are feet into it. If you know that this is what you have to do, it's something you have to do. So, you know, the joy of your dog not pissing all over your carpet is, in some ways, you get up when the dog needs to go out in the morning and you make sure that, like, it's not about a mood. It's not like, oh, I don't feel like taking the dog out. It's like, the dog needs to go out. And that, like, these small joys of regularity are there, of like, it doesn't, you don't always have to have your heart in something for it to be something that's good for you to do. And I think I'm trying to understand that in a larger context in that way of, you know, just because you don't want to do something, or that you don't desire to do something, or that you're not even something that you normally do on your own, which is very feet-based, the head knows that the way to sell the thing is you got to figure out how to relabel it.
But not every offering laid at the altar has to come with this transcendental, like, mind-melting psychedelic experience, and that you're not necessarily doing, quote, bad spirituality if you're just like, it got done.
Yeah. The letter of the law is there for a reason.
Right.
It can be the very thing that we need to hear. And it's, you know, it's the description of, like, even in recent discussions, right, of the difference between rules and values, that both are good to articulate so that people understand perhaps the spirit of the law as well as the letter of the law.
Yeah.
But the letter of the law prevents you from committing crimes, from breaking up things that you don't, you know, relationships or otherwise, or harming things. And then the spirit of the law is something to understand that, like, that is the actual truth. Like, sometimes people break a law, but it was actually good that they did. And so those types of things are all part of this, I guess, on the sacrificed on the heap, you know, of the pyre that is the Tizia, I suppose.
Yeah, that the rules, the letter gets to be the bumpers on the bowling alley, right? That keeps us on the, quote, straight and narrow. But the spirit of it is actually what's propelling us along as this ball hitting the central point.
Maybe. Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the last remaining thing is to kind of tie in, like, sun lore in a healthy way, you know, because why not? We're doing actually pretty good on time. I guess the question is, in this passage of the sun, in this triumph and health that the sun traditionally kind of brings to the reading and the revelation of secrets and the truth that is associated with this light.
Illumination, yeah.
Yeah, this... I guess this idea, of course, that this is the triumphant Jesus returning on Easter morning. And I guess we can definitely see that in the fact that, like we talked about heavily on the, I think, the Cyprian episode, which is the lore around Eshume Noichi and, like, the eclipse being such a prominent thing, that lore. But to eclipse the sun at Jesus's death, the source of light is now darkened, that the darkness is falling in an unnatural time and for quite some time. And that this is when, as you said, the graves of the dead are opened and things are... Zombies are happening.
Well, the sun has entered the underworld, right? Yes. The sun harrows every night, and the son of God is off to do that and perform their rescue mission.
And what's interesting, I guess, with the eclipse notion, as we gear up towards during Eastertide this year, is a major eclipse in America. It is, it is rare that we get such a total eclipse. We had that one in the late 2010s, right? But this is, you know, Western New York and a lot of that band, there will be total eclipse on August 8th. I think it's still pretty big eclipse here in the Valley and in New York City. But it's fascinating to me that the lore around eclipses, what that is. It's always obviously solar eclipses are at new moons, lunar eclipses are at full moons. But the relationship to knowing that this is going to happen, but the effect of having been during the solar eclipse with Rebecca Boyer out on a mountaintop with a few other people, and that you can see, you can see it coming. You can see the darkness coming in a way that is very cinematic. It was also pouring rain. So you could not see the sun because of the cloud cover, but you could see darkness falling and approaching the mountaintop. It was a very strange supernatural fear.
Yeah.
this is wrong. Like, what is happening is amazing to watch, but also a fear that, like, I didn't expect to rise up in me in watching this, of watching darkness come racing at you.
Yeah.
It wasn't
Uncanny, uncanny, uncanny.
a total darkness.
Yeah.
You could see slightly because, again, there was cloud cover, and it wasn't a total. It was very close to where we were, but it still was a. It was a very, very strange experience.
It wasn't just a thing happening in the sky through, some suitable like eye protection of a thing that's happening to the sun. It sounds like it was a thing that was happening like to the earth.
Yeah, there were 50, 70 of us on this one peak that she didn't expect that many people there. I'm really glad we went up anyway, of just the absurdity and being rained on during an eclipse, of like I'm being bathed in eclipse right now. And that's like I couldn't ask for a better consecration, but it was still such a powerful experience. And I'm not gonna try and, it's not, I don't think you can duplicate such things because that was all spontaneity, but it's a moment I forever share with Blood and Spice Bush Rebecca there. It was a real gift for sure. And I think about that with this, and what it, just the darkening during when it shouldn't happen is illness. It's death, right? In the sense of it's an easy extension because I don't care if I know scientifically what's happening. It was definitely a palpable sensation and one I will not forget. So
That which is phenomenologically real or
yeah.
different, a different kind of true.
And I, again, not selfishly just because I went through it, but yes, because I went through it. That was what exactly what happened. That is, those types of experiences shape and change our advantage on things. And so I think about that with the sun card of like, interesting to pick this of all times that, within days of this episode being released, there will be the blackening of the sun for a large part of the states. So this is, I think it's just a little over a week after this is released. So happy Good Friday in that sense, and happy Easter of the sun and what this is and all this sun lore that's there. But yes, the sun at midnight, but like the sun is like now stolen. Like it's the underworld serpents coming to steal the apple seeds of light once more. Like there's nothing we can do here except wait it out to see if it goes away. But I remember watching Disney cartoons when I was little, and they talk about chickens going to sleep during eclipses because it's dark. That's all they're for. And it's this different thing of like, God, how the more you're aware, the worse it is, type of thing of like, I worry about time of day and things like it's dark as when you sleep. But as a
Right.
human, like, no, I have another 4 hours of light. I should. What are we talking about? I'm like, where to go? What's happening?
The veiling of the lamps.
Yeah. And what that is, even within Jesus's death, of like the darkening of things, the ripping of the Parakeet and the Shekhinah coming out, and like the dead awakening and all these things are like, if the centurions or whomever say, like, surely this was the Son of God, like, whatever you believe in is kind of those things of like, there's a lot going on right now. I'm not sure what it all means, but damn!
The uh-oh moment of
Yeah!
synchronicity when you've done something and then something apparently external seems to mirror or answer it. Ruh-roh.
So anyway, I think that's a good, pretty good wrap on a Good Friday episode. We're recording this on the equinox, a little more than a week before, which is its own thing, right? Of balance, and the sun now tips the balance into light. And certainly Easter is always an extension of this, right? It's the first Sunday after the first full moon after the equinox.
Right, so the interplay of Sol and Luna.
Yeah, and the difference between when that moon can fall, how soon to spring equinox it can fall, is part of the difference between the different Easters and Passover correlations. But I guess with that is thank you for 33 episodes, Al, of this extended theme, because it all is Golgothite for us, digging up things that should probably stay dead, and creating new chimeric heresies to justify why we do what we do. But
Well, it's
thank you.
great to cross spades with you.
Yeah. We still have to get our double onesies out and take a photo shoot sometime. But thank you, listeners, for 30. We're not going anywhere. This is not a goodbye, but it's just 33 is it's a thing, for the semi-regular, mostly irregular podcast that we are. So thank you for sticking with us. New listeners, thank you for joining. And as always, look for our updated talks and appearances and shindigs on the website. We try to keep that up to date pretty well. There's links there to our personal pages and other projects that we're doing. The Facebook group for Folk Necromancy is out there. That goes through different permutations as well. And I hope we'll be doing a few more Speakeasies of the Dead soon. More information on that is also on the RadioFreeGolgotha.com, which is mini conference talks and things like that. I know that you've got several talks coming up in various conferences, including the Salem Spring Agora. I've got VGS. There's just in Botanica Obscura, I believe, right? And there's a lot going on always. So thanks for taking the time, dear listener, or maybe the plural, to spend some time with us, and hope to see you at some of the events as the kind of conference season seems to start after the winter.
Exciting times. Yeah, thanks everyone, appreciate you.
Thank you. Yeah, balance your volleyball of fire. Yay Jesus. Yay Judas. Yeah. Something.
Yeah, may your sacrifices keep the world alight.
Yeah. Wednesday Adams dance and scene. Judas, Judas.